The inspector rode with me to the radio station. Whatever vehicle he'd used to get to the country club seemed to have vanished into thin air. We spent most of the trip in silence. Being some kind of otherworldly, interdimensional being, he probably didn't have much use for small talk. He didn't say a word until we arrived at the station and got out of the cruiser, slamming the doors behind us.
"We don't know what we'll find in there," he warned. "Whatever you do, Mark, don't let go of your gun."
I nodded and patted my holster. The doors opened for us automatically, and we strode into a cool, spacious lobby with a receptionist desk and a few cushioned chairs. Photos of smiling radio execs lined the walls, along with a few pieces of Pacific Glade memorabilia. News clippings about local heroes, pictures of Lake Lucid at sunrise, even an old ham radio perched on a little shelf by the window. The floor was carpeted in blue and white checkered patterns as we approached the desk. The receptionist looked at us from her computer and smiled.
"Can I help you, gentlemen?" she asked.
In response, the inspector lifted some kind of badge, no idea where he'd gotten that from, and shoved it into the woman's face.
"FBI, we have reason to believe one of your stations is broadcasting terrorist propaganda and we want to shut it down now."
The woman looked up at him, raising a quizzical eyebrow, and I fully expected her to protest or make a fuss. Instead, she asked,
"What frequency is it?"
I shared a look with the inspector. In the confusion back at the country club, I don't think either of us had taken a closer look at the radio's call letters. We were too focused on shutting the damn thing up. Thankfully, the inspector spoke up before I could think up some half-assed explanation.
"The signal's been bouncing from station to station. Near as we can tell, it took us a long time to track it back to the source."
He stowed the badge back in his pocket and said,
"Ma'am, this broadcast is a domestic threat. Several people have already been killed because of it. We need to shut it down before it can hurt anyone else."
Damn, he's good. The woman still had a puzzled expression on her face, but she seemed to believe us at any rate. She rose from the desk and led us over to a side door. We followed her into a dimly lit hallway with a few dark doorways and a single window at the end of the hall. A neon red on-air sign hovered above the first two doors. The receptionist brought us to the door at the far end, this one devoid of any sign, and rapped a few times on the frame.
"Marcy," she called softly, "there's a couple of men here to see you."
Light spilled into the hall as the door opened and a woman's face peered out at us. It looked like we'd caught her in the middle of filling out paperwork. A decorative lamp on the desk lit up her dark skin and vivid blue business suit. She eyed me and the inspector with some unease.
"Yes," she said. "I'm wrapping up for the night. Is there something I can do for you?"
The inspector flashed his badge again and recited the same bullshit story that he'd told the receptionist. I expected her to get indignant and demand that we'd leave at once, but Marcy surprised me.
"The terrorist propaganda," she said with a snort of laughter. "That's a new one. Do you boys want to hear what we actually broadcast here?"
"Of course,"
the inspector answered, glancing warily at me. Marcy brought us to one of the on-air rooms and pushed the door open quietly. The space inside was divided by a large pane of soundproof glass. Behind it, two men in flannel shirts and headphones were having a conversation into a set of mics. Their voices issued from a mess of buttons and speakers on our side of the glass. Neither voice matched the sports announcer or the sultry baritone that we'd heard at the country club. "So, Alan, I heard you met a pretty young thing down at the Hanging Rock. Care to elaborate for our eager listeners?"
"Let me tell you, Joe, I haven't been this disappointed since Barbara Streisand didn't swallow."
"You always were a nasty old dog, Alan." The older of the two men, Alan, made a jerking off motion with his hand, presumably for the benefit of his co-star, since, of course, the audience couldn't see it. Joe burst into a fit of laughter and said something about freaky women, but at that point my cheeks were red and I was trying not to listen.
"It may be garbage, but it's harmless garbage," Marcy said. She closed the door on the two men. "I don't know where you got your information, officers, but we're not broadcasting propaganda here. Just old-fashioned bathroom humor."
She went on, but I wasn't listening. I just seen something through the window that made my blood run cold. The inspector hadn't spotted it yet. He was staring at the closed door as if he was trying to burn holes in it with his eyes. Hell, maybe he was. I had no idea what he was capable of. His cigar smoke had taken on a shade of deep cherry red.
"Do you have another station?" I cut in.
Marcy paused.
"Ages ago, yes," she said. "There's a radio tower about a mile away, but it hasn't been operational for almost 10 years now. There's something wrong with the building. Asbestos, I think."
"Well, I don't know about asbestos," I said, pointing out the window, "but I think you might be wrong about that tower." Everyone turned to look. In the distance, just close enough to see, a steady red light was blinking in the darkness.
Inside me, I felt the inspector tense up, his fingers growing tight around his fake badge. Marcy frowned. That can't be possible. We moved all our equipment to this station when we switched locations. There's nothing left to broadcast over there.
It's very possible, the inspector muttered, and I think it's safe to say we found the source of the signal.
He stowed the badge in his coat pocket and strode off down the hallway, leaving me to hurry after him. I took a second to glance back at Marcy. Strange sheen had come over her eyes, and her face had grown solemn.
Be careful over there, she said.
Her concern caught me off guard. Even though she couldn't know the truth, she could at least sense it, the shape of it. Like anyone who grew up in the Glade, she understood that there was something fundamentally different about this place. Something off. And she knew that whatever was behind that signal was bad news.
We will be, I replied. Just doing our job.
Normally, I wouldn't let another soul touch the wheel of my police cruiser, but the inspector was already in the driver's seat when I joined him outside. And I figured, what the hell, I wasn't going to pick a fight with Detective Lovecraft. There was a lot more at stake tonight. The inspector pulled out of the parking lot, tires skidding, and sent us rocketing down the road towards the distant blinking tower. My seatbelt dug harshly into my shoulder blades. I pulled my phone out of my pocket, fully prepared to call Marconi, but found my fingers typing out another number instead. My wife answered on the third ring.
Hello? Hey, honey, it's me.
Tires rumbled in the background, and I asked, Are you driving?
Yes, she said. I took the kids out for ice cream. I hope you don't mind. You've been out so late, you know? And they were getting antsy.
I could hear Rory arguing with Steven in the back seat. The soundtrack of my life these days. But that wasn't the only thing I heard. There was also another voice in the car. A smooth male baritone. Announcing tomorrow's weather.
Hey, do you trust me, babe? I asked.
A pause. You know I do. Another pause, longer this time, and then... Are you about to do something dangerous?
Don't worry about me.
I glanced up at the radio tower, now looming closer than before, growing steadily in size as the car shot through the forest.
Hey, just listen, turn off the radio, and drive the boys straight home. Lock the doors, grab the baseball bat, you know, the one that we keep under the bed. And whatever you do, don't touch the radio. I can't stress that enough.
My wife said nothing for a few seconds, and I wondered if she thought I was crazy. Then the announcer's voice went dead. Rory and Steven kept up their banter, oblivious of what was going on in the front seat.
We're almost home, Ruth said. I'll make sure the boys stay inside, and Mark? Stay safe.
I always do, I replied.
It was a lie I'd uttered many times before and would no doubt utter again, but that was just part of the job. We'd accepted a long time ago that tomorrow was never guaranteed.
I love you, she said.
And the phone went silent in my ear.
I lowered it to my lap and stared through the windshield, the tower jutting out of the trees before us like a great skeletal finger, stabbing at the clouds.
The red light at its tip pulsed brightly in the growing darkness.
We're here,
the inspector announced, and the old wooden structure appeared suddenly amongst the trees. Its windows were boarded up, and most of the paint on the paneling had peeled away. By all rights, the place should have been dead. But there was still that glowing light up top. It flashed in and out as it broadcasted its deadly signal across the Neverglades. The inspector brought the car to a stop and I stepped out, slipping my cell phone into my pocket. Ruth and the kids would be all right. I was the one who needed to watch his back. The front door was boarded up with a set of planks, but the inspector tore them off with his bare hands, the rusty nails squealing as they came loose. He tossed the boards casually aside. I watched them as they flew through the air, struck a tree and tumbled to the forest floor in a heap.
You know, you're awfully strong for such a scrawny guy, I said.
Even as the words left my mouth, I saw the inspector's body ripple, his true form flashing into view for a few seconds. It was like getting blinded by a 1,000-kilowatt camera flash. I had to blink a few times to clear up the after image.
Let's go,
he said, ignoring me.
We can't afford to waste time.
He forced open the door with his shoulder and hurried inside, pistol raised. I followed him into the gloom. So far, so good. Except for the one big fuck-up. In my concern for my family, I'd forgot to call in Marconi for backup. If I had any doubts that we were in the right place, they evaporated the second the inspector and I stepped inside. The supposedly abandoned station was teeming with machinery. Cracked rusty consoles sat on every spare surface, vines poking through the holes in their screens, or at least they looked like vines. A closer look revealed that they were actually thick, tangled wires. The wires sprouted from the walls, too, stretching across the ground in spiral patterns, each cable heavy with purple moss.
I wouldn't touch anything,
the inspector said, ducking underneath a hanging wire.
That kind of moss doesn't usually grow this side of the rift. I have no idea what it'll do to human skin.
I inched forward, cautiously, being careful to tiptoe around the fuzzy purple wires. They gave off a slight metallic stench with a tinge of ozone. There was a faint humming in the air, almost imperceptible. And I realized the wires were vibrating. The closer we drew to the next room, the stronger the vibrations grew. I could feel the sound jostling around in my skull.
It's an organism,
the inspector muttered.
Not just a radio wave. And its heart is close by. You can hear it.
I hissed out a warning as he placed a hand on the door, but the inspector pushed it open anyway, revealing a flickering space the size of a small studio. The wires grew dense and more tangled than ever as they retreated into the dark space. The inspector brushed them aside and entered the room. I followed him, gun raised, keeping a wary eye on the tangled cables. The space between the door was another recording studio, bigger than the one at the community station, but utterly devoid of people. Tiny portable radios lay in piles on the floor, all tuned into the same staticky channel. Every so often, I heard the occasional blip of a voice that couldn't make out what it was saying. A single outdated TV set sat on a table behind the soundproof glass. The pane itself was shattered, wires stabbing through the holes, but the curved screen of the TV was intact. A dark shape lurked behind the static. I could barely make out the outline of a human face and neck.
Show yourself, the inspector said suddenly, scaring the shit out of me.
His cigar smoke had turned a pungent yellow. He crossed the room and placed a slender hand on the glass.
You've proven you're capable of human speech.
So let's have a conversation.
The vibrating hum grew louder, and the image on the screen became less shaky. Took on a sharp line and curves. At first, I thought I was looking at a silhouette, a person's face cast in shadow, but the image grew crisper. Then I realized, the hairs on my arm prickling, that the figure had no face at all. Just a pure black dome for a head, a little chunk of carefully sculpted obsidian. The stony face that wasn't a face cracked at the bottom, stretching into an unnaturally wide smile. The teeth that grinned out at us were pristine white and razor sharp. It was like staring into the maw of a shark.
Inspector, the noble defector. Come to play with the Paramecium, have you?
It was all the voices we'd heard at the country club mashed into one. Man, woman, animal, howling, static. An abrasive mix of all the worst sounds you could imagine. Every syllable made my head throb. I wanted to clap my hands over my ears, but that would mean letting go of my gun, and I sure as hell wasn't going to do that. So I stood there and endured the voices with gritted teeth. The inspector seemed unaffected by the grating sound.
Why I'm here is none of your concern,
he said to the figure behind the screen.
What I want to know is how you got here, and why you're killing these people.
The shark-like smile curved upwards in an arc that would have stretched the limits of any human face.
Because they have hands. Because they have feet, and tongues, and brains. And I'm not so gifted. Static rushed in, and the voice dropped an octave. But you wouldn't know, would you, Mr. Too Good to Walk Around in a Flesh Suit?
You didn't answer my question,
the inspector said.
How did you get through the rift?
The figure opened its mouth, but instead of speaking, a chorus of game show bells came ringing out.
Oh, that is the wrong question. Please step inside the box to await your punishment.
Then candid laughter from an invisible audience. Box. What is it talking about? I said. The laughter cut out. The figure on the screen whipped its head around so fast the image blurred for a moment. Even though it had no eyes, I knew it was looking at me. The mouth opened again, and a long, orange tongue licked the tips of those razor-sharp teeth.
The brave detective,
said a new voice, and I nearly dropped the gun because it was Ruth. The thing inside the TV had captured her voice to a T. I felt my hands grow numb around the pistol, but I kept it aimed at the screen. You're not my wife, I said. You can cut the shit now because I'm not falling for it.
course I'm not your wife. I'm better than her. You love each other, but your flesh suits keep you separate. I can be in you, with you, in ways she never could. I can bring you unity, intimacy like you've never known. I can be every rush of euphoria, every surge of happiness. You want that, don't you?
Of course not, I wanted to say, but my lips wouldn't move. Neither would the rest of my body, for that matter. Every muscle had gone rigid. The voice continued to murmur sweet nothings in my ear, and then I felt it. Something cool, airy, and sticky crawling into my ear canal, digging invisible claws into my flesh. No! The inspector bellowed, and the glass panel shattered inward, sprinkling jagged shards across the floor. The TV set flew backwards and crashed against the wall. As the screen cracked, I felt the invisible presence vanish from my ear, and all at once my muscles turned to jello. My weakened body slumped against the nearest pile of wires. A patch of moss brushed my hand, and pain instantly shot through my arm, and I yanked it away. I saw that my skin had become red and inflamed, as if I touched it to a burner on a stove. The overhead lights began to flicker, and the sudden whirring filled the room. The sound of an automatic door sliding open at the far end of the studio in a darkened corner we hadn't even noticed. A pair of men lurched out of the shadows. They moved with the same clumsy gait as the corpses from the country club. The inspector almost didn't see them in time, but he reacted quickly when he did, throwing the first body against the wall and kicking the second square in the chest. The man staggered backwards. I lifted my gun and shot him between the eyes. Gray goose splattered against the walls of wires as the headless body slumped to the ground. The shadows stirred and I shouted, "There's more of them!" I got to my feet and fired another couple of shots into the darkness. None of them hit home, but in the flash of the gunfire, I saw about five or six other figures hobbling towards us. The inspector pulled out his own gun and fired at lightning speed, taking out three of the corpses in less than a second. But they were coming still, even the ones missing chunks of their flesh, and our ammo wouldn't last forever. "This way!" the inspector yelled suddenly, grabbing me by the arm and dragging me down the side hall. The wires here were thick as boa constrictors, and there was more TV sets strewn around the ground, each displaying the same dark, grinning face, staticky voices drifting up from them as we passed.
Barbasol is the number one way to soothe your existential dread of the fleshy prison you call your body. And it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're dead at the old ball game. It's raining blood and guts over there, folks. Chunks of viscera dropping from the sky. Bring an umbrella and a vomit bucket to work. Inspector, Inspector, the monster detector. Does your friend know who you really are? Does he know the things you've done?
The inspector responded to this last taunt by smashing the closest TV screen with the toe of his boot. The candid laughter that followed had something dark and heaving in the background, like the sound of a grizzly bear throwing up. I could feel my eardrums burning again, but there was nothing I could do except run, run, run. Finally, the two of us burst out of the hall into a fresh air of night. I wanted to book it to the cruiser and get the hell out of there, but the inspector held me back. "Look," he said. You were standing underneath the radio tower. Up close, I saw that every beam was teeming with purple moss. Dangling from the center in a sickly blue cocoon was a shape I can only describe as an enormous human heart. Scraping footsteps echoed from the hallway behind us. I pivoted and fired a few shots back into the darkness, but they went wild, the demonic voice laughing as the bullets ricocheted off the walls. The walking corpses were almost on top of us, and I couldn't understand why the inspector was holding me still.
"When I say run," he said suddenly, "I want you to head straight for the cruiser. Do you understand?"
"What about you?" I asked, firing another bullet. This time it sunk into a meaty shoulder, but otherwise did little to slow the body down. The inspector spun me around so that we were staring eye to eye, his purple irises flashing an alarming shade of red that I'd never seen before, matching the cloud of crimson smoke bellowing from his cigar.
"Do you understand?" he barked.
I nodded. What else could I do? As the walking bodies grew closer, the inspector stepped away from me and tore the cigar from his mouth. I said tore because the thing came free with a great ripping sound like someone pulling off a band-aid. The noise was so harsh it had me wincing. The tip of the cigar ignited like the head of a massive match. Then as I watched, the inspector drew back his arm and launched the cigar through the air at the dangling blue heart. It flew like a torpedo, changing its shape in a subtle way that I couldn't describe. One second it looked like a cigar and the next, it simply wasn't. The glowing object struck the center of the cocoon and exploded on impact. Hot white fire spread along the tendrils of the moss, turning the tower into a fiery beacon against the sky. Bits of hot debris rained around me, singeing my skin, and I realized the inspector was shouting for me to run. I raised my arm to shield my face as I rushed through the blaze. The fire was spreading hot, unnaturally fast, and for a scary moment, I thought it surrounded me on all sides. Then a hole opened in the flame, and I darted through it. The sleeves of my uniform were still alight after I staggered through it, so I flung myself to the ground and rolled back and forth in the wet grass, trying to stifle the flames. A guttural shriek made me look up from where I was rolling. The radio tower had turned into a blazing white pillar, with a writhing heart caught in the center. There was no sign of the bodies that had been chasing us, or the inspector, for that matter. I lay still on the grass as the shriek rose a few octaves, becoming less and less human, before reaching its highest pitch and dissolving into a final mass of static. That was the moment the radio tower sank in on itself, like a drooping wet sandcastle. The flashing beacon at the top collapsed into the center with an almighty crash, bringing the entire structure down, causing great embers to leap outward and spark against the grass. I rose to my knees and felt for my gun. Nothing should have been able to survive that collapse, but if a set of charred, flaming bodies came staggering out of the wreckage, well, God forbid I'd be caught with my guard down. I waited for 3 minutes for something, anything, to emerge from the ruins. But when a shape finally appeared amongst the flames, I held my fire. It was the inspector. His 7-foot silhouette melted out of the fire as easily as someone might slip through a lightweight waterfall. Before I could ask him if he was okay, he knelt down and picked something small off the ground. The flames came rushing inward, as if sucked by a great vacuum, billowing over themselves until they spiraled down, down into the thin shape the inspector held in his hands. When he brought the cigar to his mouth again, it was glowing bright, but the blaze behind him had vanished. There wasn't even a single spark left behind. Jesus, I breathed. Did you kill it? Inspector nodded. Behind him, the crispy patches of purple moss were decaying into a puddle of goop, much like the stuff inside the radio victim's skulls. The bodies that had been chasing us were barely more than charcoal, and my own skin was red and inflamed. Between the moss and the flaming debris, I wouldn't have been surprised if I had a few third-degree burns. At least I'd made it out. At least I was alive. In a job like this, you're grateful for whatever miracles you get caught in. That fire must have been seen for miles, I said. Did you get the hell out of here before somebody comes to investigate?
Agreed.
The inspector stuffed his hands into his coat pockets and glided away from the wreckage, leaving me to follow in his wake. This time I was the one to slip into the driver's seat. I kept the headlights low and stuck to the side roads. When the trees lit up with the flashing strobe of another police car, I slipped off the curb and waited in the shadows. The cruiser zipped past us unaware, its sirens blazing. Broadcast is dead, I said. So does that mean it's over? No more brain-melting zombie waves? The inspector frowned.
Yes and no. I don't think our friend in the TV set will be bothering us anymore, but there's still the question of how he got here in the first place. Which is my biggest worry right now.
What do you mean?
I mean, that old station was supposed to be abandoned. No wires, no speakers, no functioning equipment. But somebody restocked the place since Marcy and the others relocated. Somebody unknowingly, or knowingly, gave that thing a home, a base of operations.
He turned to look at me in the darkness.
If there's someone out there letting things through the rift on purpose, and giving them the tools to survive on this side of the veil, we should all be worried. This could be so much bigger than a single rogue time eater or a brain-hungry hive mind.
The thought had crossed my mind already, and it only made me feel more uneasy to hear the inspector vocalize it. The trees around us burst into flashes of color as a wailing fire truck zoomed past. I wonder what the officers would make of the collapsed tower, the charred bodies, the heaps of old radios and TVs. Must have been like walking into an episode of The Twilight Zone. What did that thing mean? I asked. The thing in the TV set. It asked if I knew who you really were, if I knew the things you've done. The inspector didn't speak for a moment, but his cigar smoke took on a thin, wispy quality. His eyes had faded back to that usual shade of purple. He still didn't look quite human, but something of the monster in him had melted away. He seemed strangely vulnerable, sitting there in the passenger seat.
I've lived a long life, Mark. And when you've lived as long as I have, you look back on your early days with something less than pride. Maybe even disgust at what you were before you became what you are. You'll have to forgive me for not wanting to dwell too long on those old days.
He breathes out a single smoke ring.
Not yet, at least.
It's fair enough, he said. But one day, you and I are going to have a chat. If this prospect worried the inspector, he didn't show it. He simply reached into the pocket of his coat and withdrew a rectangular slip of plastic.
Here,
he said, passing it to me. I turned it over in my hands. The surface was reflective, so I could see my own face, but nothing else. The card itself was blank.
It's my calling card,
the inspector said.
I try to keep my eyes open for any sort of disturbance in the glade, but sometimes I miss things. So if you're tracking something dangerous, something more than just a human criminal, and you need my help, ignite that card.
Ignite? I said, raising an eyebrow.
Trust me. I'll come as soon as I can.
I shrugged and tucked the card in my pocket. Hopefully we get a breather first, I said. This was a messy one. I don't know how I'm going to explain this in my reports.
You'll think of something,
the inspector said distantly.
If you don't mind, Mark, I think I'd like to walk back on my own. Just to clear my head. You understand?
Are you sure? I asked. It's a long walk back to the station. The inspector smiled.
I think I'll be okay.
He opened the door and stepped out into the night. Before leaving, he placed a hand on the frame and said,
"We did well tonight."
Are you kidding? I said. You did well. That thing with the exploding cigar was insane. Maybe one of these days I'll save your bacon instead of the other way around. His smile grew a fracture. Then he closed the door, gentler than I expected, and strode off towards the moonlight horizon. Before I revved the engines and began the journey back to the station, I watched the inspector wander down that stretch of road. Part of me expected his body to just vanish as soon as he got too far, dissolving into mist, but he didn't. He remained a lonely figure with his hands tucked into his pockets and his fedora bowed. And I realized then that something the monster had said had struck home with me. It was hard to imagine someone like the inspector being hurt by such a trivial taunt. But he was hurting. I can see that now. I wish I knew why. Wish I could talk to him. But this wasn't the time to push it. He'd tell me when he was good and ready. And in the meantime, there's nothing else to do but get back to my desk and try to bury this whole case in mounds upon mounds of paperwork. And that was the plan, anyway. When I got back to my office, Marconi was waiting for me by my desk. She was chewing her customary wad of gum so furiously I thought she might crack a tooth. "Marconi," I said, wrinkling my brow, "what are you..." She slapped me across the face, hard enough to make my jaw sting. I raised a hand on my cheek, half expecting to draw away blood. I'd seen Marconi pissed before, but never to this extent. Her eyes burned with anger, and her lips had been drawn into a definite scowl. "Hannigan," she seized. "I told you to call me the second you got a tip on this case. Now you stumbled back in here, reeking of smoke and burning all over your skin. You want to tell me what kind of shit you've been up to behind my back?" "Jesus, Marconi, I'm sorry," I said. Talking was painful. Every syllable made my jaw throb. Things escalated quickly. The inspector and I were forced to act on a sudden lead, and I forgot to call you in the confusion. It's nothing personal. "Do you think I was born yesterday?" she said. "Much as it pains me to admit, you've got a good head on your shoulders, Hannigan. You don't just forget things. For some reason, you're keeping me out of these investigations, and I want to know why." I remained silent. My jaw hurt too much to talk, and I wasn't sure that I had an answer for her anyway. "I'm a big girl. I can protect myself. So don't feed me any bullshit about keeping me safe. If anything, you need me. You boys would have been toast if I hadn't stepped up in the bluffs." She took a step closer to me, and I thought that I saw some of the anger dwindle in her eyes. "I just want to help, Mark. Why won't you let me help?" I met her gaze. It was surprisingly hard. Maintaining eye contact with Marconi was like staring into a bright light for too long. "Look, I know I haven't exactly been open with you," I said. "It's just these cases with the inspector, they're different. Weirder than anything I've ever seen. If you really want in, I guess I can't stop you, but if you open this door, there's no closing it. You may not like what you find on the other side." She snapped her gum and smirked.
He always had a melodramatic streak, you know that? Don't patronize me, Hannigan. I know we're up against some dangerous shit. I saw that thing on the bluffs, and if there's anything even half as crazy still running around out there, then it's my duty to stop it. It's our duty. So promise me. Promise you'll call me the second this inspector of yours comes on the scene. What could I say? Marconi was one hell of a cop. And truth be told, it was better to have her around. Aside from some archaic sense of chivalry, there's really no reason to keep her out of this. Promise, I said. Jesus, Marconi. Lay off the physical violence next time. My jaw's still stinging. She smiled and slapped me again. This time on the shoulder. I'm just glad your sorry ass is still alive. Now go home, wash up. You got plenty of reports to file tomorrow. Yes, ma'am, I replied. Marconi left, leaving behind the faintest whiff of bubblegum. I decided to call it a night. My body was burnt all over, and I was in desperate need of a shower. Plus, Ruth and the boys would be waiting for me back home. I don't get nights off too often. When I do, it's usually a quiet affair. Beer with dinner, TV with the boys, maybe a little fun with Ruth, if we're both not too exhausted from work. Tonight, though, would be different. The thought of doing anything physical made my entire body ache, and after what had happened at the station, I wanted to steer clear of television for a while. So maybe this would be a quiet one, just a peaceful night in with the people I loved. After such a chaotic day, I think I deserve that much. Hey there kids, it's me, Mr. Creepypasta, and once again, it's the end of tonight's video, so I want to tell you all thank you for listening or watching, however you hear my voice. Whether it be on YouTube or on the podcast, thank you so much for being here with me. There's going to be a new story every Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday night right here on YouTube, or if you're not watching on YouTube, that means the podcast gets updated on SoundCloud, Apple, Google Play, and now the podcast is on Spotify, so if it's easier for you guys to listen there than it is to listen on YouTube, then hey, not such a bad deal, right? As always, any support you guys give towards Mr. Creepypasta's Storytime really does help me out. I can actually keep the lights on in the house, and I can get nice little cat treats for Hercules. Okay, sorry for taking up so much of your time. Thank you guys for listening once again, and sweet dreams.